Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Republicans clamor for Chris Christie. Alabama stays tough on immigration. Bad cantaloupe, Europe in the thick of it, and a big American-born Al-Qaeda leader is reported killed. At the Reagan Library, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was begged by audience members not yet satisfied with their field to enter the presidential race, but said the answer this week was still no.
That heartfelt message you gave me is also not a reason for me to do it. That reason has to reside inside me.
As Europe looked for a way out of its debt crisis, the Greek prime minister promised his country could be counted on, even as many still see default coming.
I can guarantee that Greece will live up to all its commitments. I promise you, we Greeks will soon fight our way back to growth and prosperity after this period of pain.
And the American-born preacher of radical Islam, Al-Qaeda's Anwar al-Awlaki, is reported killed by a U.S. drone strike in northern Yemen. CNN's Mohammed Jamjoum reported from Istanbul.
This is huge news. Anwar al-Awlaki has been a fugitive on the run from Yemeni officials and U.S. officials for many years now. He's a very charismatic figure in Yemen. He's considered very popular. And he's somebody who's very popular within the Al-Qaeda organization.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Chrystia Freeland of Thomson Reuters Digital, John Heilman of New York Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What do you think of Chris Christie, the GOP field, the death of al-Awlaki, Alabama on immigration, bad cantaloupes? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined today from New York by Chrystia Freeland, editor of Thomson Reuters Digital. Chrystia, welcome back. Great to have you.
Great to be here, Tom.
With us from Washington is John Heilman, national affairs editor for New York Magazine, co-author of Game Change, Obama and the Clintons, McCain and Palin, and the Race of a Lifetime. John Heilman, welcome back to you as well. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
And hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Chrystia, and John.
Let's dive right on in. He's dead now, we're told, but here's the voice of the American-born Muslim preacher, radical, who has inspired, we're told, more than a dozen plots or attempted attacks. Before all that happened, at the end of a Hellfire missile today, we're told, here's al-Awlaki's voice from an English internet message posted last year.
I, for one, was born in the U.S. and lived in the U.S. for 21 years. America was my home. I was a preacher of Islam involved in non-violent Islamic activism. However, with the American invasion of Iraq and continued U.S. aggression against Muslims, I could not reconcile between living in the U.S. and being a Muslim, and I eventually came to the conclusion that jihad against America is binding upon myself just as it is binding on every other able Muslim.
Anwar al-Awlaki, who we're told now dead. First report said they didn't know how it happened. Later reports say an American Hellfire missile fired from a drone in northern Yemen, which is al-Qaeda in Arabia territory. Chrystia Freeland, what about the impact of this killing? He's been reported dead before, but if indeed this turns out to be entirely true, the impact, Chrystia?
Well, you know, I think in 2008, if we had been sitting around making predictions about what would be one of the big successes of the Obama administration, I'm not sure we would have said, you know, they're going to be really great at going after al-Qaeda. But that seems to be the case, doesn't it? Right?
We've now had bin Laden. Mm-hmm.
I think that this is significant. I also think that it's not unconnected to, you know, in terms of thinking about what's happening to that part of the world, which for the first decade of this century was really the area that America felt most threatened by. You have to think about the Arab Spring as well. And I think, you know, we have to say in a world where there's a lot of economic bad news, there's some political good news coming out, isn't there?
Yeah, well, I certainly on the counterterrorism front, this has to be seen that way. John Heilman, what's your sense of how people are assessing this? I mean, this was a guy who was in contact with people all over the world, charismatic figure, had that famous email exchange with Major Nidal Hassan, the Army psychiatrist who shot, killed 13 at Fort Hood back in 2009. Do we win in the Arab world with his death or just in our sort of counterterrorism tote board, John?
Well, you know, there was a complicated question, Tom. I think first the first thing to note is that this is a target that the U.S. has been trying to get for a long time. He's a very important target, a very high value target, and if you talk to people in the defense and intelligence communities this morning, you know, you're going to hear coming out of there in the next couple of days people saying things like, "This is VQ Day. This is the day for some people where we can actually start to feel as like we can actually declare victory over al-Qaeda," and that is probably a little bit overdrawn, but it is a significant day in those terms. And I think it's we've demonstrated not only that this guy, as an operational matter, is very important to have taken out al-Aqqi, but also there is also a symbolic importance to this in the sense that I think al-Qaeda now understands that the U.S. can get pretty much anyone, and that our degree of effectiveness in terms of executing these drone strikes and trying to decapitate al-Qaeda has been demonstrated to the nth degree. The drone program is obviously a double-edged sword in the region, and it is a way that we have been effective in taking out, decapitating al-Qaeda, but it's also inspired a lot of backlash and a lot of resentment in the region because we are, you know, effectively dropping missiles and bombs on people in this kind of automated, dehumanized way from above, and there has been collateral damage, and so there is a downside to it too. But on the counterterrorism front, make no mistake, this is a very big day for America.
Jack Beatty, here's a man who inspired, at the very least, any number of attacks, it appears, and hit, as John and Christian say, with the drone fire here. Now, we're told during the period of uprising and chaos in Yemen, their piece of the Arab Spring, still very much unresolved and pretty bloody, U.S. has really put the pedal to the metal on the drone program there, put a new Middle East drone base somewhere in the Mideast, no one's saying where, and used the kind of open season of the government there in such turmoil to go in hard, Jack.
To go in hard and to go in against an American citizen. You know, this is a watershed, it seems to me, in the way in which this war on terror has undone, or at least loosened, our constitutional rights. There's been no due process here, no trial of this man. He was assassinated on the president's say-so from a hit list, apparently, that has two other Americans on it. And the rationale is
Jack, if I may, another American, I'm just getting this news off the wires, another American al-Qaeda member also killed in the same attack, Yemen is saying today.
He may be one of those people. And the rationale, of course, is, well, they're on the battlefield. And what is the battlefield? The world. Have we reached that point now where, you know, without even, you know, the rudiments of any sort of due process, a man is assassinated? Now, I don't doubt that he whipped up hatred and he was inflammatory and so on. We do have free speech in this country. I'm not sure that his rhetoric went over the line. It was fire in a crowded theater. But we're, you know.
But Jack, aren't we on the battlefield? I mean, you know, it is a complicated world. He lived in America till he was 21, but he was fully in that world and very fully and publicly in the al-Qaeda effort, explicitly, you know, in his case, in language we can all understand, looking to take down the United States. What do you do?
Well, what do you do? It seems to me that it would be much better for us if this man could have been apprehended and tried, and there wouldn't be this aftertaste of, you know, during the Cold War, the argument was, we don't want to become like the Russians. We don't want to have a spy network. We don't want to have star chambers. We don't want to have all the apparatus of the security state. Well, we did have those things. They did weaken our rights. And I'm afraid the war on terror is having a similar effect.
Eliza in East Hampton, Massachusetts is calling right now. Eliza, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Jack, you've said a lot of what I was going to say. I just think this is an extrajudicial murder on foreign land of a U.S. citizen, which the press is saying is U.S.-born person. I just don't know why NPR isn't more reporting about why this is against international law. If another country came into our country and killed George Bush or Dick Cheney on our territory and then said, well, it was because they committed international war crimes, you know, I mean, that wouldn't fly here. Why is this flying with us?
Eliza, we've got it. We'll look at it. We'll look at it. And let me get one more, if I may. Jerry in Buffalo, New York. Jerry, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I was just wondering, Bush had successfully drew support from the middle to win re-election when he made the claims that he had made the country safer. And I think that I wonder whether the Obama administration is going to beat that same drum. And I'll take your response off the air.
Jerry, I appreciate it. John Heilman, here you go. Eliza wants to know why this is going on. Jack worries about the constitutionality. Jerry points to politics, and, you know, there's an election coming. President Obama in some considerable trouble, and, you know, maybe this works for him politically.
Yes, and they're all those questions are kind of tied up in the same bundle in some ways, Tom. I share some of Jack's concerns and some of Eliza's concerns, and I think it's ironic to note that, you know, to go back to what Chris said at the very mm-hmm. beginning, I think you would never have expected, many of the supporters of Barack Obama would never have expected, that when they elected him in 2008, not only that he would be so successful at prosecuting the war against al-Qaeda, but that he would do so by extending a lot of the policies that are complained about on the grounds that Jack and Eliza are complaining about them from the Bush administration, that Obama has not only adopted those policies, but in some ways extended them and pursued them in what a lot of people see as an extra legal way, with a ferocity and as I said, efficiency that I think, again, many of the president's supporters would have told you were crazy in 2008 or 2009 if you would have said that. On the politics of it, that is the answer to the question. Look, I mean, for most people in America, the notion that an American citizen who announces as straightforwardly as this gentleman did that he wanted to wage jihad against the United States, that most Americans in our political culture think that guy has announced himself to be fair game and that we should do what we have to do to take that person out. Mm. The administration will blare this as a success going into the election. It will be one of the ways in which Barack Obama is one of the strongest cards he has to play.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Republicans beg Chris Christie to run. Bad cantaloupe. Court support for a tough immigration law in Alabama. Al-Qaeda man Anwar al-Awlaki is reported dead, killed, and a lot more going on. Christian Freeland, editor of Thomson Reuters Digital, with us today from New York. John Heilman, national affairs editor for New York Magazine, co-author of Game Change. And our own Jack Beatty is here. We've got a lot of people thinking about this killing, this man, this moment. Janet in Auburn, Alabama. Janet, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am saddened when anybody is killed, but I have to disagree with Jack on this. I think it was a necessary bad thing to do a better thing. Hopefully, prayerfully save thousands of other lives, both American and Afghani and Pakistani, because of the way that this war is being waged. And I think if we could continue to spend our military resources on intelligence and intelligent action, that it would be a much better use of our money. I feel now the man has not had our justice, but he is in the hands of God, and there's the justice.
Janet, we've got it. Jack, let God sort him out.
Yeah, well, he's got his justice. I think she makes an excellent utilitarian point about this.
I mean, after all, he was behind plots to bring down airliners on Christmas Day.
Right, right. The greater good for the greater number. I mean, maybe that is the case. On the other side, have we crossed a line in terms of our own legal structure? The thing that makes us, you know, we vaunt American exceptionalism. Well, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
And have we in this utilitarian, and I think she's probably even right, moral calculus, have we done injury to ourselves?
Gabriel in Manchester, New Hampshire. Gabriel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm just wondering, how legal is it to kill Americans, regardless of what they say or think or even do, without a trial? I just think that we should be outraged and we should stick to the Constitution, or else America will lose this war. Thank you.
Thank you, Gabriel. I mean, our president was a constitutional law professor, so he knows that this is in tough, tough territory. One more right on that front. Nasser in Boston. Nasser, you're on.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention that I would like to have a commission to pick I'm a Pakistani. I'd like to have a commission to take care of al-Zawahiri so we can close the chapter on al-Qaeda. I think it's well done.
So you're happy al-Awlaki has been killed. You'd like, I mean, what Leon Panetta said in July, that his two top goals were to get al-Awlaki and to get the new leader of al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri. You're a Pakistani, and you say, yes, please, do it, Nasser?
I'll do it myself. Just give me a commission.
Okay, now we've got the posse on the road. He'll do it himself. Nasser, I appreciate your call as well. I mean, it is interesting, Christia. We've got so many drones flying out there now, and this news coming in a week when we had another homegrown plot. The FBI tells us to send a kind of homemade drone or drones into the Pentagon and the White House. This Massachusetts man, 26 years old, out of our backyard here, Rezwan Ferdows, physicist, and, got into this situation, Christia, where he was apparently working with undercover FBI, thinking they were al-Qaeda, and hoping to send some, remote-controlled airplanes right into big targets in Washington.
Look, I mean, I think we're coming back to the point that we've all been making, which is, although it's quite easy when you look at economic policy to condemn this administration for being slow moving, for being indecisive, for being bad at the politics, they turn out to be pretty good at, what I don't like calling the war on terror, at the fight against al-Qaeda. They just turn out to be able to do it. I mean, maybe this is a little bit of a Nixon going to China moment that they are able to get away with measures which a conservative president would find himself much more fiercely attacked by the left for taking. And, I do have a lot of sympathy with the point that Jack and some of the callers have been making. I think in terms of the public politics, that reaction is going to be fairly muted. And I think in terms of the presidential race, this is going to be one of the few Trump cards that President Obama has. In terms of the wider world, what I think that this does is really increase the importance of strong support for the countries that have had revolutions in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to be aggressively pursuing the attacks on al-Qaeda leaders if at the same time America is showing that it is supportive of, new, yes, difficult, yes, beleaguered, yes, chaotic, but new leaderships that have been brought to power by democratic revolutions. And I think that piece now becomes increasingly important if America wants to be seen as not hypocritical in the Middle East.
To balance the ledger there. And to the utility argument, we hear it. Let us hope nobody else starts flying drones around. We saw an amateur attempt, we're told, this week. I want to turn to politics. They were hot and interesting this week in the Republican Party, where we had this big meeting at the Reagan Presidential Library, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie there Tuesday night. And what comes from the crowd? Begging by audience members there for him to change his mind and run for president.
Are you reconsidering or are you standing firm?
My Italian mother, she told me to tell you that you got to run for president.
I really implore you to, as a citizen of this country, to please, sir, to reconsider. Don't even say anything tonight, of course you wouldn't. Go home and really think about it. Please.
And, of course, him saying no. Kept talking about a video on political.com that showed a montage of his previous answers to that question. Here's a segment of that video.
I'm not running. I'm 100% certain I'm not going to run. I don't want to run. I don't feel like I'm ready to run.
First, you have to have, in your heart, you got to want it more than anything else. More than anything else. I don't want it that badly.
John Heilman, what is going on in this bit of theater?
Well, a lot of things. Chris Christie, first of all, has all of those previous statements, I believe, are now inoperative. He is very seriously considering getting into the race. His mind has been changed about the advisability and desirability of conceivably running. Now, not necessarily about the possibility. He's got to still. There's a lot of daunting challenges for a guy who is going to, if he were to decide to get in, would be doing so really 3 months before the first ballots are cast. There's huge logistical and substantive issues he'd have to confront. But
and just a month before he has to sign up for these Florida primaries, which are moving nearer and nearer and nearer.
Correct, but I think that some combination of the degree to which the Republican field is unsettled, a huge degree, I think he has been swayed by both the insistence of the pleading for him to get in and the caliber of some of the pleaders, which is to say he has become the an E-Day fix in a lot of ways for a lot of the Republican donor class and for a lot of office holders around the country, some very serious people, past presidents, past secretaries of state, people who have been telling him that he must get in, that he can win, that he can handle the presidency, and that I think most importantly that this is his moment and that moments like this do not come around that often for potential presidential candidates where not only can you run, but where the stars are coming into alignment and that this may be his best and clearest shot at winning the White House. I think he's taken that advice on board and has had a significant change of heart. Again, I'm not predicting he will get in, but until a week or two ago, he was really never serious about running. He is now serious about thinking it through over this weekend.
Jack, right out of New Jersey, Newark Star-Ledger. Yesterday, Governor Chris Christie is seriously rethinking his months of denials and may launch a campaign for the White House. Sources close to the governor there saying, here we go, Jack. What's creating this great draw, this great pull for the big governor?
Well, I think the two things, Rick Perry's faltering, the debate performances, especially last week, they've really hurt him. 11 points in a Fox poll just in a week, and he was going to be the savior. The savior from what? From the second issue, Mitt Romney. He's gained, I think, only a point of the points that that Perry lost, and Republicans simply aren't warming to him. On the other hand, any objective observer of those debates would have to say that he's done admirably in all of them and made his points and seems to have taken to, as he didn't in 2008, to have taken to that format. And the Romney problem, you know, what is going on? Why can't he catch fire? Earlier this week, someone on NPR asserted, I think Cokie Roberts, that his Mormonism was part of the issue. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't know. I've been looking at polls on that, and they're all over the lot. You can find about 20% of evangelicals and about the same amount of liberal Democrats who said, no, we're very much less likely to vote for a Mormon. But that reservation seems to pale for Republican voters next to the individual mandate. 6 in 10 there say they're less likely to vote for someone who supported the individual mandate in health care. So it sounds like that would have a more negative effect on him than his Mormonism, but we'll have to see.
Let's hear from Dave in Manchester, Connecticut. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Look, what do you think?
I'm a relatively conservative Republican. Mm-hmm. I did vote for Joe Lieberman. I'm in Connecticut. But honestly, you know, I mean, we ran John McCain in 2008.
So?
We don't need to run Christie as John McCain in 2012.
I'm not sure. What do you mean by that? What's the parallel or the contrast? Or what are you saying there?
He's the same guy. Compromise, socially liberal, fiscally conservative, trying to reach across the aisle. He was just before, I think, at the Reagan Library last week saying, I'm looking for a compromise. We all got to compromise. Look, I'm tired of compromising. Compromising for the press and for the Democrats,
yep.
essentially the Republicans do what the Democrats want, and we get a little grease pack on the side.
Well, that's funny because Democrats say the other way around. But where does that leave you, Dave? Perry? Michelle Bachmann?
Bachmann, no, I don't think she's got it. I would like to see like a Kane Rubio ticket, something like that. Where I can see sort of a balance. I'd like to see a Hispanic running in a vice presidential spot. I like Herman Cain. I think he's a straight shooter. He's a little more socially liberal than I like, but I think he's a straight shooter, and I think he'd make a great president.
I think it would put a
quash on all those people who say I'm a racist because I don't like Barack Obama.
Right. Don't step back an inch. A Cain Rubio ticket. Now we're getting nothing. It seems like only yesterday that Perry was supposed to be the big hope for people just like Dave here, Christian, John, Jack. Then, as you say last week, Jack, in that debate, people watching Perry and just wondering if he had the stuff. Here was a moment in last week's Fox News debate in Orlando where he's kind of tripping over his words while trying to make a criticism of fellow candidate Mitt Romney.
I think Americans just don't know sometimes which Mitt Romney they're dealing with. Is it the Mitt Romney that was on the side of against the Second Amendment before he was for the Second Amendment? Was it was before he was before these social programs from the standpoint of he was far standing up for Roe versus Wade before he was against Roe versus Wade? He was far race to the top. He's for Obamacare, and now he's against it.
I mean, it's those are hard. The spotlights are on. It's not easy, but the expectations are high if it's a president. Saturday Night Live had a big time with that. That debate moment mocked mercilessly. Guest host Alec Baldwin played Rick Perry. Bill Hader played moderator Shepard Smith. You'll hear Baldwin as Perry first.
Ship, if I may, I'd like to attack Mitt Romney as a flip-flopper.
You sure it's late in the debate? This is when you normally get tired and confused.
Well, not tonight. Yeah, I'm ready. Mitt Romney said he was against Obamacare. But what about Mitt Romney? I mean, Mitt Romney care. Was it was before he was before?
Okay, so SNL can go after anybody there. But let's let Mitt Romney speak for himself here. He defended himself pretty crisply here against, in his own terms, against the flip-flop criticism at a town hall meeting in New Hampshire Wednesday.
In the private sector, if you don't change your view when the facts change, well, you'll get fired for being stubborn and stupid. All right? And so it was Winston Churchill said, when the facts change, I change too, madam. What do you do? All right? So I'm very happy with where I am and the things I believe in. If people want someone else who believes something else, there are plenty of people available.
Jack Beatty, Mitt Romney is the GOP's Churchill.
You know, I've never heard political expediency done up as a principle quite like that. I mean, what has changed? He's not talking about adjustments to facts in the world. He's talking about his adjustment to the increasing conservatism of the GOP electorate. He's saying, I changed my views to match theirs, raising the question, what about your convictions? And I think that's, you know, perhaps this saying this is what we do in the private sector, perhaps people will be mollified. Perhaps others will think, well, this is exactly the problem with you, Mitt. You just don't seem to have any convictions.
Parker in Stowe, Vermont. Parker, you're on the air.
Yes. I would just like to say that I think Christie is hi, Tom, by the way, is a great choice for the Republicans as far, because I'm a Democrat, and he just seems like a Republican that I would choose over anybody else that's looking to become president right now. Because, I don't know, I'm just, they just seem like all the same person over and over again. And seeing someone new and different is kind of refreshing, I think.
Parker, we've got it. You're for him because of that. Our Republican Dave is against him maybe because of that. Christopher Freeland, you're there in New York. You look out over New Jersey. If he ends up in the ring here, what's the country going to see?
Well, I think that it was a great choice of yours, Tom, to play some of those clips of Rick Perry, because Rick Perry's weakness is both a temptation for Chris Christie and an illustration of the dangers. So the temptation is, you know, a few months ago, Rick Perry was in the position that Chris Christie is.
Mm-hmm.
And he was,
please,
you know, the
Rick,
great
please.
White
Get
hope.
Yep.
Please do it. He was going to be the guy who transformed things. A very popular, very successful governor of state. Not as bipartisan, but a great jobs record, etc. And we've seen him really, really very quickly the shine coming off. And I think one of those quotes from that montage you had of Chris Christie saying, I'm just not ready. I think that that is sort of the Christie brain speaking. But it's very tempting, as John was saying, you know, it's very tempting to hear powerful, wealthy people saying, Governor Christie, this is your moment. The only other point I wanted to make is picking up on something that John said. What is really interesting to me is how much what John described as the Republican donor class doesn't like Mitt Romney. They really, really don't like the guy, which is kind of astonishing to me, because you would think he would be the perfect person for rich
He's
Republicans.
He's the money guy,
not
the corporate
working.
Man. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Kenyan Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai, who fought for the environment and for women's rights, is dead at 71. She was a bright star.
I always like to look for the silver lining and hold on to that silver lining and say, I must get over this hurdle. And if you can do that, when you get on the other side, you feel, oh my God, hula, and you feel strong about the fact that you didn't give up.
A great one goes. The first stage of a new Chinese space station lifted off on Thursday. A little problem with America the Beautiful, oddly played in celebration, but never mind.
Engine started. And we have a liftoff. The liftoff of Long March 2F rocket carrying China's first space module, Tiangong No. 1, into space.
The Long March 2F rocket, wow. And music producer Sylvia Robinson, the driving force behind the first big hip-hop label, died this week at 75. She rounded up the Sugar Hill Gang, produced a landmark single, and broke open the hip-hop age. Here's Rapper's Delight.
He said 1, 2, 3, 4, tell me one, the mic, what are you waiting for?
To the hip-hop, the hippie to the hippie, the hip-hip, the hopper, you don't stop. To the bang, bang, the boogie, say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie beat.
We're looking at a week in the news. Republicans beg Chris Christie to run. Bad cantaloupe. Court support for a tough immigration law in Alabama. We'll look at it. Al-Qaeda man Anwar al-Awlaki is dead. And on the news goes. John Heilman is with us with New York Magazine, national affairs editor there. Christian Freeland is with us from Thomson Reuters Digital, joining us today from New York. And you can join us along with Jack Beatty. He's here. Rhodes is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Rhodes. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well.
By the way, John, Game Change is really a great book.
Hey, there's one for you, John.
Thanks. I just wanted to say that here in South Carolina, I'm a pretty big Democrat. Sometimes I feel like I'm one of, you know, maybe 10. But I do not see anybody getting excited about Mitt Romney. And I know you all know that South Carolina has picked the Republican nominee every year since 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And people are just not fired up by him, whether it be business-oriented Republicans, social, conservative. None of my GOP friends seem even remotely interested in him.
Where's the fire, then? Where's the fire?
I'm especially not down here. I mean, I don't even think it's primarily the Mormon issue, although I'm sure there are some social conservatives that are concerned about it. But even with Perry flopping, I still see more people interested in Perry.
That's a frontline report, Rhodes. And you're right, South Carolina, with that big role, every time, all the time. I mean, John, what do you think? Is it strong enough? The really deep urge for a very conservative reply to Barack Obama that Rick Perry doesn't have to be articulate to be the one who gets the nod.
Yes, I think that it's foolish at this point to write Rick Perry off. There's no question that he has had a tough time in some of these debates, and there's no question that, especially among Republican establishmentarians who were a little bit skeptical, at least, of Rick Perry from the very beginning about whether he was smart enough and had enough policy chops to be a plausible candidate, that has hurt him with those people. With the Republican grassroots and with the Tea Party faction of the party, with the evangelical part of the party, I'm not sure that I think Rick Perry is in unrecoverable trouble, and I think that he's going to need to perform better, obviously, in debates going forward. But look, the Republican Party is split. There is a large portion of the party that is, as I said a second ago, Tea Party / evangelical. There's another part of the party that is what we used to think of as the old mainline Republican part of the party, the establishment mainstream part of the party.
Yep.
There's a big divide between those two. For an ideal candidate would be someone who could appeal to both, who could have the enthusiasm and acceptance of the establishment, but also fire up the grassroots, the more populist elements of the party. I think that's part of what's driving the interest in Chris Christie, because people believe that there's a chance that he could be a guy who could compete in both brackets, the establishment bracket and the populist bracket. Rick Perry is still, I think, the guy to beat in that populist bracket of the party. Mitt Romney is still the guy to beat in the establishment bracket, but there's still uncertainty and less than total commitment to both of them, which again brings us back to why there's been for the last year a yearning for more candidates, a market for other alternatives, and right now, in particular, a market for Chris Christie.
Let's take a call from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Herman's calling. Hi, Herman. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. I was wondering, you know, when the economy was falling apart during the fall of 08, and the President Bush put out the call for help from Congress to pass certain bills.
And bail out a lot of banks, Democrats, and really dive in, yep.
Well, the Democrats rushed to help out President Bush, and particularly to save the economy, and they did at the time. But now that President Obama is putting out help to the Republicans to save the economy, they're resisting doing that. So why is it that the Republicans think that...
They don't need to help now? Herman, that's an interesting contrast. Of course, Republicans would say because he's got the wrong recipe. But surely there hasn't been a big reply when the president was reaching out. I mean, this week, Christian, Jack, John, he was even having to reach out pretty hard to his own corner here, criticized by some, the president has been, including California Representative Maxine Waters, over time, and many others. He was with the Congressional Black Caucus last weekend. And, you know, here's how he closed his speech to his own peeps, let alone the GOP.
Take off your bedroom slippers. Put on your marching shoes. Shake it off. Stop complaining. Stop grumbling. Stop crying. We are going to press on. We've got work to do. CBC.
Maxine Waters didn't go for that close to the Congressional Black Caucus meeting. But you hear our Ann Arbor caller, Chris Jez, saying, wait a minute, why isn't the GOP stepping up with the president to work on the economy now? And the president sort of throwing his arms open and hectoring a little bit, his own maybe base there, saying, come on, let's go, get your marching boots on.
Look, I think that this is the question that has bedeviled the president since his election. He was going to be the great bipartisan unifier, and he discovered there was the other side didn't want to be united. I think that it's only really this summer, it's only since the discussions around the debt ceiling and some sort of deficit deal, those falling apart, I think, were a real turning point for this president and this White House. I think that there was genuine hope there that it was going to work, and real dismay that it didn't. And I am hearing now a very different tone from people in the White House, that they are now saying, look, we get it. We understand that the Republicans do not want to do a deal with us. We understand that we have to more aggressively and more directly present what we would like to do in an ideal world. And we have to really make that case, even if the Republicans aren't going to play ball with us. So I think that since the summer, we have a really new story that we're hearing. The question is, maybe it's too late.
Maybe. We'll see. Jim in Omaha, Nebraska, what do you think, Jim?
Hey, Tom. I think the deciding factor in the election is going to be the huge silent majority, which is kind of in the middle politically, and we obviously don't know how many there are because they're silent. We think that, you know, most of the Republicans are kind of wacko, except for Romney, who's been thought of as kind of wishy-washy because he is in the middle. And the same thing with Obama. He seems to be more moderate, and he's felt to be wishy-washy. So, I mean, that's a real conundrum with this huge silent majority, and we don't really know who to vote for.
Jim, that's interesting. You say wacko, but Jack Beatty, what about it? I mean, that's the old formula is that big middle will decide the election. Do you think that's the case this time, Jack? Or could it be decided by real passion, you know, real motivation at the edge or at the wings, and maybe this time the right wing?
Well, Charles Krauthammer wrote a column with some data in it the other day, pretty much making that argument, that the passion remains on the Republican side. And there's a deficit that we have seen really now for a couple of years, chronically, on the Democratic side. The disappointment in President Obama from his own base is going to deprive Democrats of the juice to put them over, whereas on the other side, they'll be able to go with their heart's content. This week, Michelle Bachmann made that argument. She said, look, you know, we don't have to just accept things now. We don't just have to say, go along with the nominee. We've got a shot because this economy is so bad that even people whose views seem as extreme as mine can get a hearing. That is taking a big chance, however, because I think Jim, our caller, really did touch on it. There is that silent majority out there. There are those independents out there. And they are not, they have not been in the past susceptible to strong right-wing appeals, not necessarily susceptible acceptable to left-wing appeals either. But I just think that in the cross pressure that they're going to feel, it's taking a big risk putting up a very right-wing candidate.
James in Newtown, Connecticut. James, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
What's on your mind, James?
Hello, am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't realize. Hello, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to suggest there's a big story that I didn't hear you mention, and that's the protest on Wall Street. And I want to thank those people from the bottom of my heart, because so many of us, and many of us in that silent majority, too, are so busy wading through the economic wreckage left by the Republican agenda from the previous administration that we're too busy to be down there. But I predict that protest is going to grow. And God bless those people. And what we need is exactly what the Nurses United Union in America is calling for, is a transaction tax on some of these high-level stock market exchanges, just like I believe Europe just passed. Isn't that true?
I don't know exactly where they are.
That is true.
Is that right, Christian? So
yes, it is. The Tobin tax. Europe passed it.
Yeah. So yes, we talked to them last week, right there in Lower Manhattan, raising quite a ruckus. The Occupy Wall Street movement. James, I appreciate your call. While we're on distribution of income and democracy, Christian, look over at Russia with us for just a minute. What is going on there? Is Vladimir Putin? Did I hear he's going to end up president until 2026 or something?
It's a possibility. I think that the events in Russia, which were happened last weekend, I think that they are really significant. So what happened was Dmitry Medvedev, who is the president at the moment, nominated Vladimir Putin to be the candidate in the presidential elections next March. And that was him saying, I'm not going to be the candidate. I'm not going to run for another term. Why this is significant is it really is the final acknowledgement by Putin and by Medvedev that Russia isn't going to succeed in becoming China, in institutionalizing this authoritarian regime. And instead, Russia is developing a more sort of strongman system, more, you know, like Egypt's Mubarak. Really, Putinism is about Putin, and it requires him to be the guy in the Kremlin. In the short term, a lot of people are saying, well, certainly Western businessmen I've talked to have said, you know, that's fine. He's a guy we can do business with. I think in the medium term, though, it means that Russia is much less stable and potentially, again, becoming a pretty scary place.
A lot to watch there in Russia. John, take us from Russia to Alabama and the judge there upholding this week Alabama's very tough immigration laws, strongest in the country. The governor there bragging after the ruling this week where immigrants or anybody can be asked to kind of show their papers. Kids show up at school. The school have to keep track of who's in the country legally and who's not. Some of the segments were not upheld by the judge, but overall a lot of it was. And it looks, John, as though sort of responsibility on immigration is headed to the states now. Is that where we're going to see enforcement any way they want to see it done?
Well, not if the Obama administration has its way, and the Supreme Court will ultimately, you know, have to weigh in on this. I think that is where this is going to get determined. This is the law in Alabama is sort of like the Arizona law on steroids. The administration objected to it on exactly the grounds that immigration is a national responsibility and that it should not, we should not have 50 separate immigration policies. That's the ground on which they objected to the Arizona law last year. As I said, I think this is headed to the Supreme Court and will be litigated on this level. The problem for the administration and in some ways the problem for the country is that to make the argument, which is a perfectly reasonable legal argument to say and a sensible public policy argument to say that it's crazy to have a patchwork of immigration laws around the country and this should be an issue that's resolved at the federal level. It's a national, in some ways, a national security issue and a national economic issue as much as anything. It's a perfectly plausible argument to make, but it runs up against the political reality, which is that our two parties have been totally unable to do what is required to come up with a comprehensive immigration solution on a national level over the course of the past decade or more. And so from a political perspective, the administration makes this argument in court, but yet has done very little to move the ball forward in terms of addressing what is a serious national problem and one that requires, by its own account, requires a national solution. And I think for a lot of people in some of these states, the attitude is, hey, I mean, And just from the standpoint of voters, the attitude is, it would be great if we had a national solution, but Washington is incapable of providing one, so we're going to take care of ourselves.
Just in short, do you expect the Justice Department to take this up to the Supreme Court, maybe?
I do.
Wow. So we have not heard the end of immigration in Alabama, but a ruling there for it. Didn't even get to Pakistan. News just over the wire that we've got American drone firing several missiles into the northwestern tribal region. This in the week when Admiral Mullen is headed out as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with some tough words for Pakistan on his way. So much going on in the world, and watch out for those Listeria cantaloupe. It's been great to have all three of you. Chrystia Freeland, editor of Thomson Reuters Digital. Thanks, as always, Chrystia, for being with us.
Great pleasure.
John Heilman with New York Magazine. Thanks, John, for being here.
Happy to be here, Tom.
And Jack, always great, my friend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, we leave you this week with the band Radiohead performing their song, The National Anthem, on the Colbert Report Monday night. They sampled a bit of our show live during the performance. On Point and Radiohead. Check it out at our website, onpointradio.org. Woohoo! We are almost famous. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.